everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Thought I'd mix it up a little bit.
Don LaFontaine there.
Yeah, a little bit.
In a world where we answer emails.
In a world gone mad. My name is William Bibbiani, not Don LaFontaine. Everybody calls me Bibbs. I'm a critic and stuff. Whitney, who are you?
My name is Whitney Seibold. I am also a critic and stuff. Sort of like golf and stuff.
We've got the sillies. We haven't seen each other for a couple of days. So we're just gabbing.
But for the purposes of this show, you can write in and call me Rockmeister McCool. That's my name on this show.
And only.
And only on this show.
Yeah. Like,
nobody calls me that in any other context.
That should have been your Schmodown name.
Rockmeister McCool.
It would have befit your actual personality a little bit more than this, like, mean, tough guy you've got going on.
The direction I constantly get from the higher-ups is, I'm Vanity Smurf.
Yeah.
That's the personality they want me to.
Well, you're good at it, actually. Yeah. I just feel like sometimes you're funnier than even that, but whatever. I think people listen to your podcast know you got some charm.
I have several personae that I can always fall back
That's
on.
That's true. Anyway, this right here, this is the podcast at the Critically Acclaimed Network, where you can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. People email us with questions, topics they'd like us to discuss, recommendations, stuff they'd like us to recommend, lists they want us to do on the fly, whatever, really. We'll just talk about whatever you want. We are happy to yield the floor to you because you listen to us talk. Least we could do is listen to you. So again, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Feel free to write in. We can't read every letter that we get because we get a lot and we're really grateful for that. But we try not to waste too much time at the front of the podcast. We want to free up as much time for as many emails as we can get to.
Oh, well, and
we want to give every email as much time as we can to at least cover the topic. So Whitney, without further ado, wait, one more. Ado. Take it away.
Oh my God.
I love that joke. I will do that joke until the day I die. I'm dying. Without further ado. One more. Ado.
It's like a Mel Brooks joke.
Totally. That's why I'm proud of it. I actually like that one. I don't know if I got that from somewhere or what, but I say it because it sounds like a Mel Brooks joke.
I like the one from Clue. Well, to make a long story short, too late.
Yeah.
Here's a letter from Kaylin. Good day, fine sirs. I'm writing with some advice.
Oh, no.
My husband and I want to watch more movies this year that neither of us has seen. We find that they make great date nights at home because we actually have to pay attention instead of being on our phones. I've been making a list of possible movies on my phone. I hope you're not looking at it while you're watching the movie. I put together a couple of Hitchcock films on the list because neither of us has seen ever a single one. My question to you is this: what do you think is the best Hitchcock film to see first? I know very little about his filmography except basically the entire plot of Psycho and that there are birds in The Birds. So the sky is the limit, Kaylin.
That's a great question.
I have an answer right away.
Okay.
Rear Window.
Interesting. I was going to say, and I'll explain why in a second since you just jumped in, Strangers on a Train. Alfred Hitchcock, for those who, a lot of people know the name. A lot of people who are newer to film fandom or maybe haven't done a lot of look back at classic cinema, cinema from before they were born, or maybe I find Star Wars is a pretty good cutoff point, like anything before Star Wars. Yeah. A lot of people don't necessarily go out of their way to see for the most part, unless it's maybe Disney or Rocky or something. But regardless, you got to start somewhere when you hit Alfred Hitchcock, whether you're starting in your 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, teens. Alfred Hitchcock is a British filmmaker who moved to America in about 1940, and he was a really innovative but very populist filmmaker who did a lot of things that were both experimental but also very mainstream and exciting. He's in many respects a best of both worlds kind of director, where he made a lot of really interesting creative decisions, had a lot of really fascinating things to say, while making just usually these very pulp, exciting blockbuster chase features, horror movies, murder mysteries, thrillers, etc. He was also a creep, you can look that up, and it's not hard to find. And if he were around today, I might be saying to myself, he's kind of a creep. Not sure I want to talk about him too much, but he's quite dead. So I don't mind saying that, you know, whatever his proclivities were, he made a lot of really excellent films. And I mean a lot of really excellent films. Mm. Like, if you go through his filmography, you will find more films that are worth seeing, like genuinely you should go out of your way, than not.
Yeah.
And he made a ton of movies from the 1920s to the 1970s. Like, his career spanned almost 50 years just as a director. Alfred Hitchcock was one of the first filmmakers I was introduced to as a form of film history education. I was in the third grade, and I've told this story before, but I had to be homeschooled for like a couple of months at the end of a school year, switch schools and stuff, and it didn't make sense to just drop me into a new environment with only a couple of months to go. So my mother, being a teacher, decided to homeschool me for a few months, and one of those, one of the projects that we did was we would watch old movies as sort of, and I would like write about them and we talk about them as art. And I very distinctly remember the first one I saw was Strangers on a Train. Strangers on a Train is, I think, a very good introduction to Alfred Hitchcock because it's not a movie that gets talked up quite so much anymore. So you probably, unlike Psycho, which you already say, like you know all about just through cultural osmosis is what I call it. But it's also, it's really punchy. It's got a great setup. It's really suspenseful. And it will hopefully get you jazzed to do more. The setup for Strangers on a Train is Farley Granger plays a professional tennis player who is in the middle of a messy divorce. He hates his wife. His wife hates him. They want to get a divorce. And he's wants to marry someone else. And retire from tennis and become a politician and be very happy. He meets rather randomly, total stranger on a train, Robert Walker. Robert Walker is a tennis fan, so he recognizes Farley Granger right away. He's also a weird, creepy monster, and he tells Farley Granger that I've always had this great idea for a murder. This is so cool.
And this is just academic, mind you.
Oh, yeah.
Wink.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people in Alfred Hitchcock movies are sort of academically fascinated with the idea of murder, which means they're going to do it.
Which means Hitchcock was fascinated by the subject himself.
And he made movies about it, so it made sense. But his characters don't. They just do it. But his idea is the problem with committing a murder is you're probably killing someone you have a motive to kill or that you know personally. And as a result, the police are going to get you. So the trick is two people have someone they want to murder. They barely know each other. They meet really randomly and they swap murders. I kill the person you want killed. You kill the person I want killed.
You don't know the person. There's no motive.
There's nothing connecting us. There's nothing connecting you with the victim.
Strangers on a train.
Yeah, exactly. And Farley Granger's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Really weird. I have to go. And Robert Walker's just like, cool, you like my plan, though, right? And Farley Granger's like, yeah, sure, it's great. And Robert Walker's like, then the game is on. He kills Farley Granger's wife, and then he starts blackmailing him and says, yeah, well, now you got to kill my dad. What? I never agreed to that.
but I did mine.
Yeah, you owe me now. And it's just this incredibly suspenseful, awesome movie. Really great performances. Robert Walker is so fucking creepy in it. It's a great setup. It's really, really fun. And because it's not the most famous thing he's ever done anymore, you'll have less baggage going in. And that's why I think it's great. But he made a lot of great movies, obviously.
Yeah. I chose Rear Window just because I think it's a good example of just sort of really flashy photography that seems subtle.
Yeah.
Like he hides a lot in the frame, but you know, you'll see it. It doesn't seem so arty. It's an incredibly approachable. It's just a good thriller. It's got some good performances and good acting. And even Raymond Burr, who plays a character who doesn't speak.
He has a couple of lines at the end.
At the end, but yeah, sort of see him through the viewfinder.
Pitch people on it, like tell people what they're in for if they haven't seen it or heard of it.
Oh, well, Rear Window, well-known setup. Jimmy Stewart plays a photographer who's injured his leg. He's stuck in his apartment high-rise, and all he has to do is sort of look out his back window, which looks out over this big courtyard, which faces a few other apartment buildings. And one night, while just sort of idly looking through his camera viewfinder from his wheelchair, he sees in the apartment across, high up in another building, some suspicious things. And it looks like his neighbor might be up to something fishy and might have murdered his wife. And how does he alert people? how does he investigate that when he's trapped in his apartment?
Yeah, he has no evidence, and even what he saw isn't really like, I was an eyewitness to a murder. It just looks bad.
Yeah.
So nobody believes him, and he can't get out there and investigate. He's just trapped in his apartment, and all he can do is continue being a voyeur. Mm. It's really smart. It's so
really
clever
smart. In terms of its basic thriller elements, it's really great.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, because he is being a voyeur, it brings something to the fore that Hitchcock explored a lot. And I think a lot of the best movies kind of explore is the fact that films turn us into voyeurs.
Yeah.
We're spying on people and we cannot be seen.
We're curious about other people's lives. We are fascinated by melodrama or violence, you know, even if we have no interest in it in our daily lives, but like we go home and we watch Law and Order.
Yeah. We're spying on cops or spying on personal lives.
We read tabloid magazines.
There are a lot of really good thrillers that sort of play with that idea, where we see things from a killer's point of view.
Yeah.
Peeping Tom, which came out in 1960.
Yeah. Right around the same time as Psycho. They were like both really influential serial killer stories. Yeah. Peeping Tom is underappreciated, I feel. Like a lot of people don't watch it now.
One of the great horror movies.
It's
period.
Phenomenal. I only just watched it for the first time like 2 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
I don't know how I'd missed it for so long. And I was just like, where has this movie been whole life?
Powell and Pressburger, the same people who did The Red Shoes and Black Narcissus.
All these classy films.
Yeah, put this together really this like, cynical serial killer potboiler about a guy who murders his victims with a camera tripod while looking through the camera. So he films them.
Yeah, it would be like if like Steven Spielberg made Halloween now. Like, it's sort of like, wow, I didn't know you had it in you, Steve. Yeah, good job. Yeah. It's really cool.
Rear Window isn't quite as bitter as all that, it does have that same voyeuristic quality.
No, I love Rear Window. I put Rear Window on my list of the 10 best movies ever made, which is actually why I wouldn't start with it, because I feel like you're starting really high.
You want to work up to that one.
And maybe if you go to like some of his interesting but like not quite as amazing movies, they're not going to seem as cool.
Northwest after Rear Window.
Well, I think North by Northwest is actually maybe up there, but like maybe something like, I don't know, To Catch a Thief, which is this very fluffy cat burglar movie, might not seem as cool after you've seen Rear Window, but it's really delightful.
My point is, don't start with Vertigo.
No! That's the trap. That's the trap.
Everyone says
like,
Vertigo is his best movie. Okay, I'll just dive right into that. You actually kind of have to know Hitchcock's style, and like I think there's a reason why it's number one on the Sight and Sound poll. Currently, like the last one, which was held in 2002. Next one's coming up.
It's
soon.
Not too late to enlist us, Sight and Sound. I know you're listening.
Sight and Sound, they're big, big fans of our podcast. And we know that they're going to just write us that email any day. We'd like you to participate in the 2022 poll.
I would kill to be part of the Sight and Sound poll. That's like my big career goal now. That's like the last thing I wanted. After that, I can die.
Mountain to scale.
Yeah. But yeah, Vertigo, it's like, it's really kind of impenetrable. The plot is really weird, even by Hitchcock standards. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very much an examination of Hitchcock's own obsessions and proclivities, which, if you haven't seen a lot of Hitchcock movies, you're not going to pick up on anyway. And I'm just going to come right out and say it. There's some really beautiful stuff in Vertigo. I do not think it's anywhere close to his best film. I wouldn't even put it in the top 15. I'm not even kidding.
I love Vertigo. I love Vertigo because it is kind of perverse. And it does have this weird dreamy quality that I like, almost borderline surreal quality that I really like.
Sure.
But it is a film they show in film schools because of its craft. And it's the kind of film that you really get into once you've been studying film for a while. Yeah. I'm not trying to sound like I'm gatekeeping or anything, but like you can watch Vertigo anytime, but it does, it is going to seem really impenetrable if you don't have a lot of foreknowledge of Hitchcock.
This isn't a great analogy, but like, you know, like, can you imagine watching like Avengers Infinity War as your first Marvel movie?
Like,
it'd be weird,
right? You don't know any Marvel characters.
Yeah, you don't know
all.
Anything about it. Maybe you've heard of them, but you don't know anything going on. Maybe you'd have a good time, but you wouldn't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
That's not Vertigo, because it's not like the 20th film in a series or anything, but it's... Knock it off.
Sorry.
It's got all of these themes that are really only interesting if you've seen Hitchcock deal with them before.
Yeah.
So I would say save that one for much, much later. But, if I had a backup... Like, if any of those aren't available, Whitney, if you have a backup to Rear Window before we move on.
Let's see. You know what? I'm very fond of Torn Curtain.
really? That's an interesting choice. I like it too, actually.
Because it's considered, like, I guess, B-level Hitchcock, or not as widely celebrated as some of his other ones.
Generally speaking.
But I think it's a good case of Hitchcock meshing well with the charisma of a star, rather than the director's voice taking over.
But you mean Paul Newman?
It's Paul Newman in that.
Yeah, like, and Julie Andrews is in it, but it's Paul Newman's movie.
Yeah, Paul Newman, like, he's the one who's really kind of carrying all the charge. Not to cast any dispersions whatsoever on the wonderful Julie Andrews, but yeah, Paul Newman just brings a lot of his own to that movie, whereas I feel like a lot, like, Jimmy Stewart was sort of Hitchcock's plaything. He was able to sort of do the Hitchcock thing. Like, that's why they worked together so frequently. Paul Newman is Paul Newman.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like, you get the Hitchcock, but you also get a little bit more of traditional classic Hollywood outside of his interests.
There's some amazing set pieces in that movie.
A good, and the climax is to die for.
I think the climax is great.
The chalkboard sequence.
The chalkboard sequence is great. The bus sequence is top tier Hitchcock.
And the bus sequence is great.
The bus sequence is amazing. Mm. I feel like it takes a little too long to wrap up at the end, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah. I think that's an underrated film. I would say, like, a good place to start with Hitchcock, if you don't go with either of our first picks, I feel a lot of people forget how funny Alfred Hitchcock was and how, even in his serious films, he's being very playful. So I would recommend, maybe as an alternative, The Trouble with Harry. which is a really cool film about a small town, and they find a dead body in the woods, and everyone has, for reasons that will be explained later in a very, well, what we now think of as maybe a Coen Brothers kind of way, has some reason to hide the body. The body gets buried and dug up like 3 times in this movie. Like, it's just this really grim thing about this corpse that is just getting in everyone's way. It's delightful. I think it's Shirley MacLaine's first movie. It's really, really funny, and I like it a lot.
Nice.
All right, let's move on.
Here's a letter from Tricky Dick Grayson.
Oh, a couple of references in there.
I only ever read how you sign off the letter. I'm not going to read your letter out of the your name out of the subject line. Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister McCrull, Glaive!
Fire barons can travel 1,000 leagues in a day.
Well, let's get some. How come there wasn't a fire bear writing sequence in Krull?
There was a fire mare writing sequence in Krull.
A fire mare. I thought you said fire bear.
No, I said a fire mare.
I'd love to see
fire mare is gonna love to fire see bear would be cool.
Love to see them writing fire breathing bears.
Okay, that would be cool. Right? We're gonna remake Krull, and that's the only thing we're gonna change is now those are bears.
Fire breathing bears. As a young adult nearing my mid-20s, I have been struggling to make my own way in the world, like many my age. Mm. To offer a little background, I graduated from a 4-year university with a bachelor's in film studies about 2.5 years ago. I've been incredibly unsuccessful in finding almost any work.
I was there.
Brother! Much less something even remotely related to my career interests, editing, post-production, home media, and film history. There are not many opportunities where I come from, the rural South, or where I went to school, so I know I need to move. With the finances of a move and the distance I would need to go in order to get decent enough area to find to work in, as well as the global pandemic halting everything, a move has been out of the question at the moment, leaving me feeling stuck and admittedly a bit of a loser. I bring all of this up because I thought it would be fun and interesting to ask what you two gentlemen were both like during that time in your life post-college and how you began your careers. Thanks for reading, Tricky Dick Grayson.
You very accurately described my mid-20s. Yeah. I wasn't living in the rural South. I was in LA, but other than that, I knew I wanted to go into film very early on, like probably by middle school. I had made that decision, and I never looked back. I went to film school at UCLA. It's where I happened to meet M. Lampas de Silva, my wife and partner now, and so that was a great decision for a variety of reasons. But after college, I lost structure, high school and college. You know what's expected of you at any given time, even if you don't like it. Like, you have the set series of goals. And then it was like, well, now what the hell do I do? And so I fell into a bit of a doldrums for a couple of years, in which I just sort of bounced from job to job, just trying to get the bills paid, wrote some scripts and things that didn't really go anywhere. And it wasn't until almost like 10 years now, probably like 7 years after I graduated, that I realized that what I really liked to do was celebrate movies and talk about them and be critical of them and basically try to contribute to the conversation. And that was what people were most interested in me doing anyway. So I started writing, started writing a lot, and eventually started doing podcasting, and now here we are.
Yeah.
But there's that sort of mid-20s malaise is something I'm very familiar with, and I can only imagine it's 10 times harder right now in the pandemic. That's not fun. I don't envy you.
When you're already in the midst of a quarter-life crisis and you feel like your life has stopped,
yeah,
and you're not nearly as far along as you should have been, and then, of course, you look... Thanks to social media, you think everybody's doing better than you are.
We're not.
Yeah. Nobody is.
We're all miserable. And a lot of the time when we're putting on a happy face on social media, we're just trying to save our own sanity.
Just remember, the people you see on social media are the constructs they made for themselves.
Yeah.
You're
talking to someone's representative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody who's trying to make you look like a version of yourself.
And that could be a very open and honest version of yourself, but that doesn't mean every single second of every single day that's who you are.
So ignore all that. Don't pay attention. Don't fall into the trap
of comparing yourself. That is not your responsibility to be where someone else was when you were 25 or 27 or what, none of that.
Things are hard enough without envy falling and glousing you up.
No.
So, when the pandemic halts everything, the grind just has to continue, and you feel extra stuck.
Yeah.
How do we get our careers started? Gosh, when are we going to start our careers?
I don't know. I feel like we have not.
Neither of us ever landed like that one plum gig, you know? Like we always had gigs here and there.
But we're not terrible at this.
You were an editor, but that was still a gig.
I was not officially hired. I didn't have benefits or vacation days or. Like when I got let go, I didn't have like unemployment or anything.
Yeah,
so like it's still a gig, you know. That's how this whole. There are very, very few like film critics who are actually on salary anymore. Like very few throughout the entire country.
I'm still
a rough gig.
Keeping my fingers crossed and knocking wood and hoping I get that someday if it still exists.
Sure.
How do you get your career started? Well, as it turns out, you just got to pay your dues. Don't write for free for someone else.
No.
They're going to say, hey, can you write for free? We're going to give you a platform. You're going to get your voice out there. They are exploiting you. Don't take those jobs.
No. There's a difference between that and like being a guest on someone's podcast.
Yeah.
No one's going to pay you for that.
If it's a friend of yours and they've started a podcast and you know them personally and you'd like to help, then you can write for them.
Yeah, that can be good exposure, but do not dedicate a ton of time and do not give them... like just your thoughts and stuff like that. Those are valuable.
Yeah,
and your expertise matters and is worth something.
But you are going to have to write for free for a little while probably.
If only for your own blog.
But
or whatever,
do it for your own blog. Publish it online. Get your voice out there through your own personal means.
Mm-hmm.
Take the time you can. If you're thanks to the internet, you know you're in the rural South, but people all over the world can read something you publish. So publish. Mm-hmm. Just start writing reviews, hone your craft, find your voice, keep it out there. Try to network, reach out to the people you know who are also doing what you're doing.
And don't fall into the trap of networking, of trying to like puff yourself up. Just be cool, be groovy, be nice. People want to be around.
Ask politely if you have a favor to ask.
Yeah, people want to be around and work with people they want to be around and work with. Like that's what it boils down to. So, like, if you're the kind of person who just is, you know, positive and, you know, hits their deadlines and doesn't have too many typos and stuff, you're kind of in.
Yeah.
So take this time. Also important, you're in your 20s. Again, I don't know if you're going into criticism or movie. You mentioned a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
Paying your dues is important in all of them. You try to skip over that step, you're just going to have to do double later.
Yeah.
Right now is the time to just sit down. Get the work done. Get good at it. Build connections based on I did the work. They liked the work. Now they'll hire me again for something. Build that up as many times as possible. Mm. Eventually it pays off.
And but it is eventual. You have to wait a long time.
And you're probably going to need at some point to get some other gig to get you through it. I worked at a Staples.
Yeah,
I worked at a Barnes & Noble.
I'm still working in movie theaters to like pay bills.
Yeah.
You're going to have to do it for a while. You're going to have to pay your bills doing some other hustle on the side or just to have a regular job. And or you could just marry rich.
Marry for love, and if they happen to be rich, all the better. But that's not
marry for love of their money that
don't
you, will
you
get
dare.
On.
Don't he's, being, Whitney's kidding.
I'm being
Whitney's kidding.
My usual sarcastic self.
But I will say this: having support, whether it's a girlfriend, boyfriend, any sort of romantic relationship, or and you don't even need any of that, family, friends, hell, a pet. Just something to have with you there and to sort of keep you going and make you feel like you're not in it by yourself, because it can be really rough.
So work a job, publish as you can. If you're in the rural South, I don't know what gigs are like, what newspaper gigs are like in smaller towns.
Not right now, no.
Maybe there's one critic, just find them and set their house on fire, and you're in.
Don't stop listening to Whitney. Give bad advice.
Well, I'm saying,
but reach out to local
publications. You know, if you can get published in a local publication, that's a toe in the door, isn't it?
Yeah.
You could say to a slightly larger publication.
But again, we're talking about how to get started in film criticism. That's not necessarily what everyone wants to do.
That's true. We're talking about
the general advice I have for the. And we've been rambling. The general advice I have for when you're out of college, you're finding yourself, you're. College career doesn't necessarily immediately translate into money. Pay your dues. Acknowledge that you're going to start small. Accept that you might have to take another gig at some point just to make ends meet. Try to make sure it's a gig that doesn't mentally exhaust you, so that when you're done with it, you can't pursue your other interests.
Yeah, that's true. If you're working one of those jobs that needs like 60 hours a week, then
it's just incredibly mentally or physically taxing, like incredibly so, and you just collapse at the end of the day, you're not going to necessarily have the time to write that screenplay or submit those resumes or whatever. So you want to make sure that you do have energy afterwards to pursue what you really want to be doing. Try to cultivate positive relationships. Try to be reliable, and eventually you'll figure it out. I will say this, the one piece of advice I would recommend, try to be flexible, because sometimes the thing that you very specifically want to do, you'll pursue it for 5 years, 10 years, and then realize there's something you'd want to do even more. And maybe it's related, maybe it's totally different. I knew some people in film school who were really wonderful and they were talented. And then like 5 years afterwards, I found that they went to nursing school because that was really what their passion was. The idea that you have to have your shit figured out and know what you want to be is ridiculous at any time, really. A lot of people reinvent themselves into their 40s, 50s, and 60s. So, so stay flexible, but pursue your goals. Do the diligence. The 20s is the time to hunker down. That's our advice, and take it with a grain of salt.
A bag of Epsom salt, if you move.
Yeah,
you must,
please. There's so many other people to listen to who are, frankly, more successful than us.
We know some incredibly successful people.
Yeah.
We've rubbed elbows with, like, actual successful critics.
We should
just
give them our microphone. Like, why are we doing this? All right, let's move on.
Here's a letter from Musa.
Hello, Musa.
Hey, Bibbs and Rockmeister, I hope you've been keeping well. Thank you for the abundance of programming that you've provided over the last year. It has been a nice constant that has kept me sane over the tumultuous year.
Us too.
Yeah, we've really tried to knuckle under, and partly for our own sake. Random sidebar, but one underrated joy I've discovered is seeing Bibbs tweet something out that's seemingly random, then discovering its origin story while listening to one of your various podcasts. Most recently, it was listening to him Google which company owns the Jingle All the Way IP to see who might be making a Turbo Man cartoon in the future, and of course it's Disney. Anyway, last year, once COVID hit, I decided to play catch up on older movies, and I didn't watch as many 2020 movies, so here is my top 10 discoveries of 2020.
Oh, great. I love these. Please keep sending these in. This is cool.
Number 10, The Forest of Love. A crushingly bleak Sion Sono picture that is impossible to turn away from because of how incredible and stylish the filmmaking is. I've not seen enough Sion Sono.
He's very prolific.
Yeah.
There's quite a few. I actually had never seen Love Exposure, which is like his 4-hour bizarre love epic, and I heard nothing but amazing things, but I never had the time to sit down with it.
About it. The story is about a young man who discovers his talent is like ninja upskirt photography.
Yeah.
Like, that is violating fellow students by taking pictures up their skirts.
Yeah.
Which
weird
is
film.
This weird sort of like kind of fetish pornography.
It's a bad phenomenon.
Yeah. But that like leads into this big, gigantic love epic that he gets involved in.
Sion Sono, if you're not familiar with the name, makes weird fucking films.
I do highly recommend Why Don't You Play in Hell?
That's maybe his most accessible movie. That's really good. It's really good. Right. But like, he's made some weird shit, and oftentimes he'll make weird shit and you'll be like, how did you make that work? No, seriously. How the fuck did you make that work? Because that plot sounds terrible. Mm. And yet it's amazing. So anyway, I haven't seen Love Exposure, but that was just one example of a film I haven't seen. Yeah.
And I've also not seen The Forest of Love.
Neither have I. I'll check that one out.
Number 9, Carrie. I regret that it took me so long to get around to this masterpiece, but it's as great as its reputation. Number 8, Sleepless in Seattle. During a year that felt bleak and hopeless in many respects, this movie just made me happy.
I remember Sleepless in Seattle was like this huge rom-com phenomenon, and I think it helped keep the romantic comedy like thriving in the 90s. It doesn't get talked about very much anymore. Mm. I think it's because the movie that it's really inspired by and Affair to Remember is also not talked about very much anymore. And I feel like they've fallen into some kind of obscurity. But I like both those movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number seven, Zaphiro LeFou. I know that Bibbs has said he's not a big fan of Jean-Luc Godard, but I love the way his movies are stitched together, and this is probably his greatest effort. A beautifully serene epic that jumps in and out of genres as well. All this stuff from like pre-Alphaville I think is pretty good with Godard.
I haven't seen that one, so I cannot speak to that specifically.
But you've seen like Breathless.
Some of his stuff, but I've seen enough of his stuff that I didn't like that I stopped fishing a lot after a while. Yeah, like I haven't sat down and watched everything he's ever done, nor have I made a concerted effort. Okay. So,
See Vive Sa Vie.
Okay.
I'll get
to that at some point.
Number 6, Desert Hearts. It is a crime that this movie didn't launch Donna Deitch into stardom, a beautifully restrained love story that has a master's hand guiding the frame.
Nice.
Number 5, Lola from 1961.
Oh.
This is a Jacques Demy film. Okay. Because this movie was made by Jacques Demy and carries a character over from Umbrella to Cherbourg.
Oh, yeah.
I, for some reason, expected this to be a musical, and the film is so incredible that I wasn't even disappointed that it's not. Hopelessly romantic in its scope of characters and wandering camera.
That's like a whole little mini cinematic universe that people don't talk about enough.
The Jacques Demy universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number 4, Model Shop, another Jacques Demy's love letter to L.A., about the aimless stagnation that war can create. An unemployed man drives around L.A. and has conversations looking to borrow money to pay his car debt as he awaits an inevitable draft order from Vietnam. That sounds awesome.
I haven't seen that one. That sounds cool.
Number 3, The Watermelon Woman. We just watched this recently. Smart and insightful about race and culture and the intersection of the two, but also just delightful and fun and funny. If there was any justice in this world, Cheryl Dunier would be as big a name as Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith broke only 2 years before that. It's not, and he didn't suck up all the air in the room, but yeah.
Mm.
We should have a skewniverse of Cheryl Dunier characters.
I just want more movies set in 1990s video stores. I think when you look at what Kevin Smith did, and I like Clerks a lot, but when you look at what Cheryl Dunier did, and it's just like, okay, when have you made something interesting and influential and cool? When have you made the fucking Watermelon Woman? It was amazing. Yeah. So, yeah.
Watermelon Woman's on Ovid right now. So get off it.
I think it's on Criterion as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Number 2, Brink of Life. I watched 10 Bergman films in 2020, and this was my favorite. Brink of Life. All right. One of his more simple and straightforward efforts, but it's also one of his more tender films about the relationship that three women form over a 24-hour period in a maternity ward. And number 1, The Children's Hour, 1961.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a William Wyler. This movie broke my heart. Hepburn and McLean, not Catherine Hepburn, it's
Audrey
Hepburn.
Yeah.
Hepburn and McLean give powerful performances, and Wyler's direction really amplifies the tragedy that befalls these women. If you've gotten this far, thank you for reading my letter, and I hope you have a great 2021. Musa.
Thank you so much. Mm. I love these discoveries because, you know, a lot of people try to keep up with the new releases, big or small, but it's what you seek out that isn't new that I think speaks a lot more to your general sort of tastes. And that's neither positive nor negative. I think it's just interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm really fascinated to see what people are looking at that isn't part of the zeitgeist. Everyone's like, you got to see this. Like, okay, yeah, but I want to see all these, and I'm going to make a concerted effort to find them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that these discoveries lists that we've had so far are really varied is so cool. And it really makes me, it really reminds me, sometimes you look at Twitter and it seems like such an echo chamber of the same things and same topics and same concerns and, you know, passions. And it's important to remember that everyone has really varied tastes. And I love that. Yeah. I love that so much. So please keep sending those in. I love those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what? If that's the case, let me find, see if I can find another.
Do we have another one?
I think we do have another list here.
That's cool.
I want to cut this part out.
The podcast. Nope. Gonna keep it in.
Gonna keep it in the podcast. Here's a letter.
Okay.
From RJ.
Hi, RJ.
I knew we got a couple more of these. Hello, RJ. Hello, sir or madam, or something else. Hello, Bibbs. Hello, Whitney. On last week's episode, one listener wrote in with top 10 discoveries they made in 2020 and inspired me to do the same. I have 11 here.
Okay.
That I want to single out, but for overall, there were 30 movies I saw for the first time that I was incredibly impressed with. Shoutouts to My Neighbor Totoro, The Farewell, Pinocchio, and my first Almodovar film, Pain and Glory.
Interesting place to start.
Discoveries, in no particular, Pain and Glory is great.
No, it's great.
Yeah, just go for it. I love Pain and Glory.
But he's so prolific, though. It's one of those ones where, like, where do you start?
He's, like, he's made so many great movies. The General, 1926.
Ah.
One that I've literally just revisited after I watched a handful of Buster Keaton movies this month. It was a real treat. Fun and captivating escapade that makes for a spectacle that could rival any adventure movie today.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's the stunts. Holy
crap. Yeah, yeah. It's all CG now. Who cares?
I know. It's
he
so
blew
much
up
more
a
impressive.
Fucking train.
So much, yeah.
Sunset Boulevard. I must admit, I'm not keen on the opening or the narration from that character, but it was a dazzling film that's very involving with an all-timer of a performance from Gloria Swanson. Other Billy Wilder films I saw last year were The Seven-Year Itch, Double Indemnity, and a rewatch of Sabrina. All greatly enjoyed.
Yeah, very wonderfully varied filmmaker. Billy Wilder is one of the best.
Raw, 2016.
Yeah!
I have a pretty strong stomach when it comes to horror, but this, it got to me. Raw is equal parts horrifying and electrifying, with an amazing lead performance by Garance Marillier.
Yeah, I really hope that one doesn't get forgotten. I feel like it was a lot of hype when it came out. A couple of years now. Doesn't come up as often anymore. Do not let that one sink into obscurity, please. It's such a good horror movie.
Raw is really good.
Yeah.
Rope.
Hey, we're going to talk about that this week.
Yeah, an early example of the one-shot style of editing and perhaps the best I've ever seen. The tension is unbearable and it's so masterfully constructed. Other Hitchcock films I watched last year were The Lady Vanishes, Dial M for Murder, North by Northwest, and a rewatch of Psycho. I really like those first two and I'm not as crazy as most are about the others.
Fair enough.
But Rope is the best I've seen thus far.
I think The Lady Vanishes is one of Hitchcock's better slight movies. It's just really funny characters and the tension isn't like as in your face as in a lot of his movies. It just sort of like slowly, the walls just very gradually close in on funny people and then they get the way out of it. It's a really cool film. I think it's underrated.
Yeah. One Cut of the Dead, which is still insane.
Everyone is talking about this. We gotta see this apparently amazing movie. The movie isn't stupid. I feel stupid for not seeing it. And I shouldn't, because no one should feel guilty about stuff like that. But sometimes I'm flawed.
The previous listener that I inspired this letter also had this on their list, and after you guys said you hadn't seen it, I also wanted to say a thing about it. It's best gone into with as little knowledge, and it's quite the ride.
Okay.
Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
I'm usually quite particular about how quickly I consider a film one of my favorites, but this launched itself into my top 100 straight away. At times relaxed and chilled, at other times infuriating and stressful. It's an incredibly important film for my money and the best of the 1980s.
Yeah.
Also, maybe my favorite use of weather in film. Yeah, the heat.
Oh God.
It'll make you really sweat.
That would be an interesting list. I've never seen, it's probably been done, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone do a really interesting, like, compendium. Like, list is sort of reductive. I think what you're doing is basically saying, here's a theme, here's a bunch of movies written around this theme or from the same filmmaker, and let's all, like, sort of put them in context with each other. I would be very interested to see, like, a really interesting scholarly look at the way that some of the most interesting films have used weather in different ways.
Yeah.
Because I've thought about it, but I never really put it together.
When I was in high school, I saw a movie with a friend, and there came the scene where, like, everything was getting really, really tumultuous in the plot, and all of these, like, tensions were coming to head, and the action, somebody was murdered, and a body was hidden, and all the rest. It was, The Gingerbread Man.
Oh, yeah, and then a lot of it was taking place in a hurricane. Like, that's where the climax occurred.
And, the climax takes place in a hurricane, and as the rain started to pour, my companion just sort of rolled their eyes and said, weather metaphor, and I never heard it just sort of dismissed so openly like that. So, and so
it's
now,
funky. It's funky.
Now every single time it starts to rain at a sad moment, I only think of that moment. Oh, weather metaphor.
Even the Truman Show. Truman Show does it funny.
The Truman Show has a little twist in it, which is kind of cute. But yeah,
yeah,
it still happens to this day. It's like, oh, I'm sad. I'm on it. Oh, and now it's raining.
Yeah. If you're not being funny, it's Los Angeles,
and it rained all of a sudden, because that happens.
Yeah. But it can be done really, really well. Mm. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, continuing. Mm. Key Largo, another discovery. Mm. Another film that became a favorite on first watch. And this is a really solid little thriller starring Bogart and Bacall. Of all the Bogart films I saw last year, the others being Sabrina, To Have and Have Not, and The Barefoot Contessa. Mm. This was the one I had heard the least praise for, but ultimately loved the most.
I saw that a long time ago, and I dug it. It's been a while since I've seen Key Largo. I'd heard High Sierra, I think that was the Bogart film I saw, that got talked up a lot, and I thought he was really good in it, but I didn't think the movie was very good. But if memory serves, Key Largo is pretty fucking cool.
I really liked The African Queen the first time I saw it. Loved Casablanca the first time I saw it, but the one that kept getting talked up and the one I ended up hating was The Maltese Falcon.
I'm so looking forward to getting it, because that's coming up real soon on Only the Best in our Patreon, where we review every single Best Picture nominee ever. I'm looking forward to revisiting that with you, because I really dig that movie, and I think you owe that movie another chance.
Maybe so.
Well, you're gonna watch it again regardless.
It's been a long time since I've seen it. I saw it back in college. My tastes have probably changed a lot since then.
Yeah, I like it more than
But you. I remember really disliking the
movie. I was really stunned when I finally saw Dead End earlier this year, which is this sort of weird film noir juvenile delinquent movie that also stars Humphrey Bogart as like this murderer who comes back to town to settle old scores and tie up loose ends, and he's really creepy in it. He's so good.
Started a lot of trends, like subtle trends that we know about but don't talk about.
Dead End is exceptional. Please see Dead End if you haven't seen Dead End.
The Party Is Just Beginning from 2018.
I don't know.
Far from one of the strongest on this list, and I almost didn't include it, but Karen Gillan's directorial debut is a strong start. I didn't know about this movie. If a little rough around the edges, having been through a similar situation to her character in the film, it really hit me personally, and I've forgiven some of its flaws in that regard.
I remember I interviewed Karen Gillan for it might have been Oculus. I'm trying to remember when she directed that, but I remember I interviewed her, and she was talking about directing her first feature, and she was really excited about it. And I meant to go see it, and I kind of just didn't get a big release, and I think it slipped under my radar when it initially came out. So I've been meaning to get around to that. I'm glad to hear it's good. I'm glad to hear it's good. Karen Gillan, if you don't know the name, she was Matt Smith's first companion on the 11th Doctor.
Doctor Who. She was on Doctor Who.
She was on Doctor Who when the 11th Doctor was on there. She was also what's the name of her character in Guardians of the Galaxy?
Oh, Nebula.
Nebula. She's Nebula in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and she's really talented. I like her a lot.
No, she was really good. It's really good in that show, Selfie, although I wasn't...
Yeah,
that was... I wasn't a huge fan of the show, but...
She was really great at it. As a star vehicle for her, it was great.
Yeah, well...
Yeah.
Her and John Cho, in particular.
Yeah, I'm not the most gigantic fan of the movie Oculus, but there's some really great shocks in that movie, and she's really good in it.
I like Oculus.
I think that's
a good, like, haunted house, screaming in a movie theater kind of movie.
There's some cool shit in that. I think Flanagan did better films, but anyway...
Dawn of the Dead, 1978. I definitely prefer Night of the Living Dead, but this sequel is incredibly gripping with an amazing use of location and atmosphere. I recently got the Second Sight box set, which contains the Cannes and Argento cuts, which I must check out at some point.
If memory serves, I feel like the original American cut's actually like the tightest.
Mm.
I feel like the Cannes cut is just kind of long.
Mm. I gotta admit, it's a slow movie. It's pretty boring.
You know, it's not my favorite. It's neat. It's there's a lot of neat stuff in it.
It's not nearly as fun as Day of the Dead.
I think
Day of the Dead is a party.
Day of the Dead is a party and a panic attack in the same film. I think Day of the Dead might currently be my favorite, although I think Night is still arguably the best. But anyway.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Hey!
I hate to say it, but it was in the Rocky Horror Glee episode that finally kicked me up in the ass to watch this, but who cares? I watched it and it's great. Some of my favorite songs from any musical, and just overall a delightfully wicked time. A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors.
Fun film.
Last year saw me rewatching the first movie, which I liked more than I remembered, and then Freddy's Revenge, which I liked even more, except for, and I appreciate that this is a cult following in the gay community, but this is just my perspective as a bisexual person. What I felt was a lot of homophobia that made me uncomfortable. Dream Warriors was by far the best use of the concept so far, and the execution was pretty rad. I wonder how I'll feel about the rest of the sequels. Oh, they get crazier.
They get crazier.
Not better, but crazier.
New Nightmare
is great. I like 4 a lot.
I don't.
5 has no plot.
5 is almost incomprehensible. Yeah. I've seen 5 like 4 times. I could not tell you what happens if you put a gun to my head. Like, I have no idea what happens in 5. There's some cool kills. That's how I feel about 4. There's some cool kills.
Yeah. The Roach Nightmare is particularly harrowing.
There's some good stuff. Freddy's Dead is just goofy. Like, it's just a goofy movie.
Like, it's pretty terrible, but it's really watchable.
It's very watchable. You'll have a good time. But, like, it's a very, very silly film.
But then Wes Craven came back and said, let me do something more fun with this concept.
And then New Nightmare is almost as good as the original, if not better. It's so damn good. And then Freddy vs. Jason is, I still think, the ultimate fan service film.
No, for sure.
Give me everything I wanted to see from that movie my entire life, it does, basically.
I don't know why people dump on that movie. It does everything right.
It's pretty fun. And
finally, Cleo from 5 to 7.
Yay!
Nightmare 3 and Cleo from 5 to 7 would be a good double feature. My first ever Agnes Varda movie, and what a treat it was. A really nicely paced film that often feels as dreamy as it does natural, and a great leading performance for Corinne Marchand. Thank you once again for the great content. And hope is always well with you both. Kind regards, RJ.
It makes me really, really happy to see how many people, and maybe it's just my timeline, but how many people who are like younger who are discovering Cleo from 5 to 7 for the first time.
Yeah. And just appreciate Agnes Varda in general.
Varda in general, too. But for me, Cleo is my favorite. I haven't seen every one of her films, but Cleo is one of my favorite movies. And just to see how alive that movie is, it's so great. So I just... It really makes me really, really happy to see that movie is finding a new audience now. And people are still just realizing just how vibrant it is and how it feels like, in some respects, it could have been made yesterday. Like, it's so damn good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Cleo from 5 to 7, go for it.
Yeah.
It's out there. It's on the Criterion Channel.
Cleo plays, it's about a young woman. I think she's a performer. She's like a model.
She's a singer.
She's a performer. She's a young famous person. And at the beginning of the movie, she is waiting for a diagnosis that could decide if she's going to live or die. And then we stick with her for 2 hours until she finds out. Mm. And what an amazing 2 hours it is. And that's all there is to it, and yet it is everything and so much more.
Yeah.
Just really incredible cinema. God, I love that movie. Anyway, that's an amazing list, and once again, what a fascinating series of films. Like Cleo and Dream Warriors.
That's a good cross-section. Thanks for sticking with variety.
Yeah.
My goodness. Cool.
I've been thinking about like how many people just sort of like... How many people follow their passions when they're watching movies? And it's like, oh, I want to see like every giallo ever made, or I want to see every kung fu movie ever made. But then there's also this element of that I think is really cool of just curiosity, where you just want to see everything, or you want to find out
sort of cinematically omnivorous,
or even if like I have no idea what the appeal of this is, so I'm gonna watch all of the Transformers movies and try to figure it out. Like that's kind of how I'm wired.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Well, I kind of want to see everything. Yeah. That's not better or worse than anyone else's thing. I just think they're different approaches, and I find those are the big two I run into a lot.
Like, I had seen all of the Howling sequels, like all 10 of those things before and all of the Witchcraft movies and all of the Puppet Master sequels before I ever saw The Godfather Part 2. So, yeah. I've caught up.
You have
I've
your priorities.
Seen it now.
Yes. I still haven't seen the new version of Godfather 3. I need to get around to that.
I haven't either. And you know what? I'm not interested.
I hear it's better, but it's that's kind of easy to do, isn't it?
I haven't seen it because I haven't had to.
No.
And I'm not interested.
I'll get around to it eventually.
All right.
Moving on.
Okay, here's a letter from Brandon.
Hello, hi, Brandon.
Dear Mr. Viviani and Mr. McCool, I just wanted to write in and thank you both, both you and one of your listeners, for recommending the film Onibaba during a letters episode that aired a week or two ago. Similarly, the idea behind the critically acclaimed streaming club, I've been trying to use the unexpected opportunity the pandemic has presented to go back and watch some older films that I haven't seen before. This is common theme we're running into here.
Yeah.
I had never heard of Onibaba up until it was brought up on the podcast, but Winnie describing the movie as a Japanese film from 1964 that's about two women killing a bunch of samurai in a grass field and selling their belongings was all it took to know it would be totally up my alley. I watched it the other day and I really enjoyed it. The social commentary combined with some surprises and horror elements that come into play during the film's second half were just as good as you made it out to be. Thanks again for the recommendation and for continuously introducing me to new films outside of the standard blockbuster affair from Hollywood Studios. From Brandon.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Here's the curious thing, and I always suspected this would have been the case, that without the Hollywood noise machine constantly dominating the conversation,
telling us what movie to talk about every single week.
Advertising, advertising, advertising. Here's like new theories about the new Star Wars preview and eight characters.
Look, we have James Bond this week, Fast and the Furious next week. We have the Croods and the new Muppets movie this week. This is all we have room to talk about.
And they're still doing that. It's like, oh, you wouldn't believe. Fans are going to be blown away by the WandaVision premiere. Yeah. You know, that sort of thing. It's still happening.
It's a fun show.
But when you take that away, people don't just sort of sit down on their couch and say, well, I guess there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They actually start getting curious
and
start seeing classic cinema and expanding their horizons. The noise machine kept you from art.
It did. I think this is true because the noise, again, that's the purpose of publicity, isn't it? That's the purpose of marketing, is to make sure that everyone knows this is coming out.
Yeah.
And how do you do that? Well, you make sure they don't know about anything else right now.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it. Just push everything out of theaters, push everything out of conversation, make sure all anyone is talking about in your movie so that people will think, oh, well, shit, I guess I have to see Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Mm.
So, yeah, when you pull that away, people still want to entertain themselves and they might turn off the TV and play chess. There's a million things you can do with your time. But if you're going to watch a movie and you have all of these streaming services, you might be more likely to take a chance on something older you never got around to, maybe cinema or TV from another country or culture. You're going to expand your horizon because you're not being shoveled the exact same mainstream pablum, much of which is good. I'm not saying it's all bad, but it's the same shit over and over, isn't it?
Yeah, it's... If all you ever do is go to your local burger joint, you go to your local Burger King, and that's all you've ever had, and then one day it unexpectedly burns down.
Mm-hmm. And you have to go to a really cool, I don't know.
Yeah, there's like a little like greasy spoon that's been there for 50 years, and they've been churning out like much better burgers for before Burger King was ever around.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, that's pretty great. Yeah. Now let's try the sushi joint. Now let's just go down Pico Boulevard and try every restaurant.
And it doesn't.
And look at me, I'm Jonathan Gold.
And it doesn't mean you're never going to want a Burger King burger ever again, but it also means that your whole horizons have been expanded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like greater context for that burger and where it came from and what's good and what's bad compared to that burger.
Exactly.
That's been the really
I'm interested about the fallout for this whole experience we're sharing together.
I actually once suggested in an editorial at one point, no new movies for a year.
Yeah, I remember.
Like,
you talking about
just
that.
Don't do any new releases. Only release the classics. I had faith enough in audiences that if they weren't going to the latest Avengers film, if you just re-release some of these art films in the same way you would release a blockbuster. Like, advertise it the same way, you know, put the previews out and all the billboards up the same way. Come see Onibaba opening in October.
Right.
From Universal, whoever bought it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That audiences would still come to it and respond to it.
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't think, oh, this is old, I'm afraid of it, it's in black and white, it's in another language. They wouldn't say any of that. They'd just say, this is an exciting horror movie. Because that film is that good. Mm-hmm. And the audiences would be
open to
seeing
it. There'll always be someone who doesn't like it, but there's always someone who doesn't like everything. Yeah. That's my point. You present it sometimes in this rather utopian way. And I think it's more like, no, it's just film is film, art is art, people respond to what they respond to, and I think we can give a lot of people a lot more credit than I think a lot of the studios do. Yeah,
but this utopian thing I suggested happened.
Kind of.
No new movies for you. Like, we had them, but it wasn't the same volume and noise that we were used to.
Someone pointed this out, and I really don't like talking about it because I feel guilty, but, like, we've talked about it multiple times over the course of our various podcasts that all it would take to destroy the entire theatrical model was one blockbuster summer that went bad.
Yeah.
One blockbuster summer where nothing made money. Boom. It's all over.
And we've both been saying that. I forgot who like brought it up.
I don't remember who it was first. It might have even been us. I don't know. But we've been saying it for a while. And sorry.
it happened.
I did not want to be proven right on that. I really didn't. And again, hopefully things will come back in some form and it'll be interesting and good. But I don't know if we can get the genie back in that bottle all the way. I don't think there's going
to
be like
There's already been a big change, and we're just going to have to see how this shakes out.
Yeah,
and
I think interesting.
I think we're going to be at home for the most part, but we have been already. So it's maybe not so much adjustment needs to happen. Anyway,
moving on.
Here's a letter from Joshua. Hello, Joshua.
Hey, Joshua.
Hey, Bibbs and Whitney. One day, we're all going to die.
Okay.
And I feel pretty anxious about that.
Me too.
I'm scared I won't see my family grow and witness future events, be it amazing or dreadful. Being a lover of film, I also dread not seeing all the new movies that will be made after I pass. I know it's a small thing compared to everything else, but do you share this anxiety? Think of any already deceased person from history, either a film director or any notable person, and imagine what kind of movies they would have loved and didn't get to see. Do you think Stanley Kubrick would have loved the A24 films?
Oh, God.
Or would Duke Ellington would have enjoyed watching the movie Soul? Thanks for taking my questions, and thanks for all the great art you guys produce.
I interviewed an actor once who had worked with Ingmar Bergman, and they told me, and this is all hearsay.
Okay.
They told me that they were just like, you know what Ingmar Bergman's favorite movie was? The Blues Brothers. Like, just because they make...
his movies were sad bastard movies.
Because A24 makes the kind of movies that Stanley Kubrick liked, that doesn't necessarily mean that's what he liked to watch. Like, he loved Eraserhead, which granted is kind of an A24 kind of thing, but it's also way too weird, you know? So...
Like, I was always shocked. Like, I was a big fan of David Lynch going back to high school, and when I first watched Eraserhead and really fell in love. And so when I finally was able to unearth some interviews with David Lynch, this was pre-internet, I was really shocked to learn. It's like, oh, yeah, I really love Bogey and Bacall movies. Like, what?
He likes old-timey stuff.
I wanted him to say, oh, yeah, like, there's this Maya Deren film, and there's only one existing print, and I only have a third of it, but you watch it, and it makes you go insane. Like, that's what I was looking for from David Lynch. Like, something just even more outré than the stuff he makes. And, no, he likes pleasant, old-timey Hollywood movies. Sure.
So who can say what various filmmakers would have liked? I can imagine some of the filmmakers would be rather annoyed at the filmmakers today who are kind of aping their shit.
right.
I imagine they'd be like, hey, you just did what I did, only not as good. What are you doing here? I'm sure that would be the attitude they'd have. But anyway.
Stanley Kubrick goes up to Christopher Nolan and says, hey, come here. Look.
But all that being said, it's fun to think about. But I've talked about this before. I am legitimately phobic of death. I think it's thanatophobia.
Thanatophobia.
Which is where Thanos comes from. Thanatophobia is the fear of death, and I am afraid of death. The actual act of death scares the living crap out of me. And yet, as I get older and I come closer and closer to the concept of mortality being tangible and people I know have passed away, I was very lucky. Not a lot of people I knew passed away when I was young, but unfortunately that meant that when I was older and they passed away, I didn't have any like sort of defenses built up. I hadn't like learned already how to grieve, and it hit me like that much harder.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's downside to everything. But I've often thought about, like, if I were dying and I found out I only had so much time, and then it's like, shit, I'm never going to find out what Marvel does with the X-Men, you know? And like, I'm not saying that I'm like, I'll be like miserable, but I would sort of be like, I was curious. I did want to know. I've written so many think pieces, whether I liked it or not. Like, I kind of just wanted to see how that was going to resolve. You know, that kind of thing. Like, it does bug me. Finality sucks.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of mortality in general. I like people, and I wish they could all stick around. And yeah, the idea that I'm only going to have so much time to experience so much in the world, and that it will go on without me, and there's even more cool stuff I'll never get to see, stinks. And that's why we have fiction. You know, that's why we talk about like futures, so we can imagine living in them, imagine what they would be. You know, it's heartening, I think, to think of it that way. You know, that we're constantly inventing these worlds to live in while we can.
There are a few. I used to have this anxiety that there's going to be great films that I'll never get to see. After I die, there's going to be all these wonderful filmmakers and new voices that are going to come and go. And I wish I could see a longer timeline. Wouldn't it be great to live, you know, 1,000 years and see, you know, what film does, if anything?
It might go the way of the dodo. Might last like 100 more years, and then they'll figure something else out. Yeah. Who knows?
But I did realize at some point, and this took the edge off a lot, was that I can't see all the films now.
That's true.
Why am I worried about what's coming?
One will ever see all the movies.
Film production could cease today, and I still would never see them all. There's so much film out there that's already to be discovered or rediscovered and talked about, and you know that could legitimately change your character for the better because you just found this wonderful piece of art that moved you so much.
Yeah,
and so. Because the volume is so great, I stopped worrying about what I'm going to miss coming up because I'm already missing it all.
I love how much strength you find from something that sounds so distressing.
It's like, okay, I'm constantly watching movies and constantly watching movies. But if your goal is to see them all, you won't be successful. When you know you're not going to be successful, I think a great weight is sort of lifted. Now you can just sort of wander at your own pace.
It's kind
of
like
there's not a deadline to it any longer.
Well, or there is.
There's no goal. The goal is to find something you would love.
Yeah. Well, you can.
Or to continue to explore in the best way you can, and as the best you can is good enough.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with the idea that there's no deadline, because I feel like the whole premise of this question is that there is one. You just don't know when it is. But I don't know. I kind of look at it like you're at Disneyland. Disneyland's cool.
It's going to close at the end of the day.
It's going to close at some point. It's going to close, and there is literally no way you can do every ride. The lines are too long. You know, you can't eat at every restaurant. You don't eat that much. You know, there's no way to see it all in one go. And so you make your choices and you do your best and you try to have the best time you possibly can while you're here. And that's basically that. I'll never see every single country before I die. I probably won't.
That you could.
I could, but I probably won't. Okay. I probably won't get to go to Antarctica. I probably won't get the... Well, that's not a country, but you know what I mean. I won't get to see every single physical location on the planet.
Yeah,
it's not possible. I can't go. I'm never going to go probably to the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Yeah, but if you start, you get it far away.
Yeah,
you go far.
No.
I'm not, start moving forward.
I've been trying more and more since I said I'm phobic. Yeah. I'm trying to look more and more at death as not so much like this horrible thing, but just as a sort of fact of life. And you just kind of make the most of everything you got, and you see every movie you can. Take every trip you can, you meet every person you can, you tell everyone who you love that you love them whenever you can, and you do your best. That's all you can do. Do your best.
Another thing that I really took a lot of comfort from is when you realize that film, as opposed to theater, it's technology-based, and it's about recording. It's about having a copy of it.
For posterity.
For posterity. And as such, if you take care of those things, if you're an archivist, that thing will be preserved indefinitely.
Yeah.
And as such, now there's this sort of idea that film is permanent. Film is a permanent art form. It will stick around. And as long as that's true, it's always going to be there tantalizing you. It's the rock that you will always never be able to travel to. And always never, I said.
Well, it works.
And then you realize that there are experiences in this world, experiences that you're going to have that are ephemeral.
Yeah.
And indeed, there is art that is ephemeral. Some of the greatest art gets its power in being ephemeral.
Ephemeral means impermanent,
temporary. Yeah. There is a sculptor out there, a Scottish sculptor named Andy Goldsworthy.
Oh, didn't they do a documentary about him?
They've actually made a couple on him. And he sculpts out of nature things, like mud, clay, leaves, ice. He'll put a stack of rocks right by the ocean, and he'll just sort of watch the ocean wash it away. He'll build a sculpture out of ice and then wait for the sun to come out and watch it melt, and it's just gone. There's no permanent record of this thing. One of his sculptures is he'll be out on a walk out on the Scottish countryside. It'll start to rain. He'll lay down on the ground, let it rain for a little bit, and then get up, and it'll be a dry shape in the shape of his body on the ground. Yeah. It's sort of like inverted shadow. And to him, that was art. These beautiful things that will only last a little while.
Yeah.
They're no less beautiful for being impermanent.
True.
That's humanity, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our lives are impermanent. We are ephemeral, and yet we are no less beautiful for the experience.
We are ephemeral, and yet we persist. And the experiences that we have, even though they may not be uniquely shared by every single other person, there will be other people who share them with you. There will be people who see the same movies you do.
Yeah.
There will be other people who feel the rain on their face. There will be other people who, whether they knew you or thousands of years from now, didn't know any of us existed. And they're going to have something similar to what we have now, even if every single thing else is different.
Yeah.
And there's something really beautiful about that, and it gives me a bit of joy. So, anyway, deep topic. Bit of a deep topic. Let's go on to one more. Let's say one more. We have time for one more email.
Okay. Let's see if I can find another fun one.
maybe a dessert.
Here's a letter from Adam. Dear Bibbs and Run RMC. RMC Rockmeister McCool. I love it.
That's fun. Yeah.
I've been thoroughly enjoying this latest season of Episode Zero, and wanted to talk a little bit about how one film in particular has an influence that extends well beyond the film of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Episode Zero, by the way, is our podcast devoted to the prehistory of the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well, right now it is.
This season. The previous season was the prehistory of Star Wars. We're doing a prehistory of Rocky Horror right now.
We're looking at the biggest pop culture phenomena ever, and we're trying to look at, like, where did it come from, because it didn't come from nowhere, and you can learn a lot about film history by figuring out the influences of the stuff you like now. So, yeah, Rocky Horror is a long and enduring cult icon. It's been really interesting to explore a lot of, like, older horror films, queer films.
Yeah.
That's been really cool.
Listening to your episode on Scorpio Rising, a synapse in my brain suddenly fired as I was instantly reminded of one of the icons of heavy metal culture. In the 70s and 80s, Judas Priest were the forefront of new wave British heavy metal. We all love Judas Priest.
Judas Priest kicked ass, yeah.
For most of their career, the band was fronted by Rob Halford, a gay man who kept his sexuality private until the 1990s. I remember when he came out. Despite being closeted, Halford would code his sexuality into his stage performances in a way that we would consider extremely out when viewed today. He would appear on stage with studded leather biker caps of the protagonists of Scorpio Rising, and would even at times arrive on stage on a motorcycle, a la Scorpio Rising. Before your episode, I was not aware that these elements had been codified by Kenneth Anger's film and had assumed that Hadford had drawn on aspects of gay culture at large. Whether Halford saw the film or was simply influenced by its impact on gay iconography, it undoubtedly had an influence on him and on the wider metal community as a result. Aspects of Halford's iconic look are still emulated by heavy metal fans today, and it's fascinating to think that a subculture which is often associated with unbridled masculinity, and which is sometimes blind to its own homoeroticism, had its roots in a Kenneth Anger film by way of a young singer from Birmingham. This, in turn, has fed back into the imagery we see in films trying to evoke heavy metal culture in a fantastic style or influences. Anyway, this is a very long way of saying that Episode Zero, and particularly the way it encourages us to consider the interconnectedness of art, has helped me to find new ways to examine my cultural interests. I'm extremely grateful for that. I hope that my own cultural relationship to the iconography of these films can enrich the understanding of others. Best wishes, Adam.
Thank you. Boy, is that nice. Yeah, we don't get a lot of feedback on Episode Zero, so sometimes I wonder if we're just dropping things into a void. So the idea that we've helped is nice.
That one, I think, is doing it for us.
Well, but it's nice to know that people are enjoying it and getting something out of it. I don't know if we'd continue it forever if that wasn't the case.
Yeah, Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising was incredibly, incredibly influential on gay iconography.
Yeah.
And what I find really cute, and heavy metal had always been a little bit queer, especially when you consider sort of the glam movement that was mixed up in New York Dolls and David Bowie.
Yeah,
and
the 80s, where there was a lot of different, there are a lot of different varieties. There's hair metal, there's a lot of varieties, and a lot of it involved appropriation of different aesthetics that challenged what was considered masculine.
Gender queering was really fashionable for a time.
Like Twisted Sister, perfect example right there. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Boy George, for goodness sake. Yeah, well, that was the metal, that, was, yeah. that was New Wave. But
it was the music scene at the time.
Yeah. And so what I find really curious is that metal in particular, as a subgenre of music, like gathered all of this like ultra heteronormativity around it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Like you look at Kiss, it's like, yeah, we love girls. It's like, you do you? I'm not wholly convinced. Like, there's always been a queer element to a lot of metal. And you know,
a lot of metal was about challenging the norms, wasn't it? It was about being counterculture. And the culture that it was counter to was very heteronormative.
Yeah,
so challenging those norms was part of it. And some people examined that a little bit more closely, and some people embodied it more closely.
The best metal, of course, doesn't talk about sex or sexuality at all. It's all about death. Metallica never sang about sex. All of their songs are about death and war and suicide and poison.
I don't think they ever do a love song once.
I remember James Hetfield was being interviewed once, the frontman for Metallica, and he said that they were playing Unforgiven, one of their bigger slow songs from the Black Album from the early 90s.
Great album, great song, rather depressing.
Black Album, one of the best records of all time, because I'm an old metalhead when I was in junior high and high school.
And I'm not, and I still agree with that.
There's a song on it called Unforgiven, which has some gentleness to it. There's also Nothing Else Matters, that's another kind of gentle song, and they play both of those during a concert, and there were couples slow dancing to Unforgiven and to Nothing Else Matters. And James Hetfield is looking out and he's talking to the interviewers like, okay, so I'm singing these songs and like see these couples slow dancing and I want to stop the song and say, you're at a fucking Metallica show. Behave yourself.
Maybe that's why he made Unforgiven 2.
And 3.
Did they do a 3?
There's an Unforgiven 3 on Death Magnetic.
There aren't a lot of songs that have a sequel.
Oh.
And Unforgiven is a fucking trilogy. I haven't heard 3. Unforgiven 2 is not great. Is Unforgiven 3?
No, Unforgiven 2 was in that like dark, like between the Black Album and Death Magnetic. They did Load, Reload, S&M, and
when they do like Clover, and
Saint Anger, which is just terrible.
They did that live thing with the orchestra.
That was S&M.
That was like
symphonic. And
it's a live album, but it's pretty good.
But Load, Reload, and Saint Anger are the pits. And in fact, Metallica was wanted to break up, and like the producer said, no, you got to go through therapy to stay together. And they made a movie about it called Some Kind of Monster.
Some Kind of Monster is like really, you will not look at Metallica like, the same way ever again.
It's like, no, these guys need to break up. No, you guys need to stay together. No,
just a bunch of neurotic 40 and 50 year olds who just don't want to do it anymore. And they're forced to.
But then Rick Rubin, like, you know, sort of the record producer saint, came down and blessed their latest record, Death Magnetic. He produced Death Magnetic. Okay. It's like, oh, they're good. They're good again. Thank goodness. I'm relieved.
Yeah.
We
got on a tangent.
No, it's fine. I can talk about Metallica all day.
I forget what we were talking about. What were we talking about? We just got off of Metallica for so long.
I don't even remember anymore.
What were we doing? We're talking about Scorpio Rising.
No, we're talking about Scorpio Rising. We're
talking about queer influence on metal culture.
On metal culture and how Metallica... Like, they're a bunch of hetero dudes, but... They didn't ever sing about death or their sexuality. They didn't sing about sex and their sexuality. They only sang about death.
Yeah.
And that's like where a lot of metal culture ended up going. And if you go into like sort of the deep, dark death pits and start listening to death metal.
Yeah.
You get some pretty twisted shit in there.
Well, you basically get the movie Mandy.
Yeah. If you want to move into a death metal records, watch the movie Mandy.
Yeah.
Mandy's awesome. I have a Mandy t-shirt.
I need to rewatch Mandy because like everyone I know whose opinion I like, again, I disagree with Whitney sometimes, but we're mostly simpatico. Like everyone I know, everyone I know who like loves Mandy is like cooler than me. So I've been meaning to rewatch Mandy and it wasn't in the mood that day or something. Right. I like it fine. I just didn't love it.
I love Mandy. Mandy's so awesome.
All right. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you everybody who wrote in.
We've got mail this week.
Thank you everybody for We've Got Mail. It is 12:39 in the morning and I am tired. Thank you everybody who wrote in. Really appreciate it. Again, if you want to write in, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We're sorry if we don't get to your email. We do get quite a few, but we try as hard as we can. And again, we love hearing your input, and boy, are you just all wonderful, interesting people who are watching cool movies all the time. If this were like a high school cafeteria, I would be sitting at your table. You seem all really cool. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for loving movies. Thank you so much for everything, really. And a very special thank you to our patrons, without whom this show and all of our other shows would not be able to exist. If you want to join up, it's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a ton of exclusive programs, some of which we discussed this week. Only the best. We review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. Holy Batman. We're going through every single episode of the 1960s Batman. All our yesterdays. We're doing every single episode of Star Trek ever. And we're just about to wrap up the original series.
That's right.
Which means we've got like 70 episodes in the can already. So that's like a huge backlog. If you sign up now, you've got like...
We have
like
three episodes from the end. We're about to do The Savage Curtain, which is the Abraham Lincoln episode.
Do you realize that we've probably spent about, like, at least... I mean, not every episode's like an hour. Some of them are like 45 minutes, 30 minutes. You realize we probably spent at least 60 hours...
Just talking.
Talking about Star Trek and recording it.
That
doesn't that seem like a lot to you?
The modern milieu, isn't it?
I guess I'll take a drink. Anyway, we got a lot of stuff over there, and we're very grateful to everyone who's already signed up. If you can't sign up, we'd love if you leave us a review. That would really help us out a lot. Wherever you find us, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, my drink. wherever you find us, that would really help us out a lot. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We're both pretty active on social media, so feel free to reach out, say hi. We got a Facebook page and everything, and it's a whole deal. And of course, M. Lampas da Silva and I, we have a new soap store over on Etsy. If you go to Etsy and look for Salt Cat Soap, we have homemade soaps. All of them currently are designed by M. Lampas da Silva, but I might have a few throughout the year. People are enjoying them. We got some good reviews so far. Thank you to everyone who's already bought one. And there'll be more designs actually really soon. First Saturday of every month, we're going to debut some new designs. Again, 99% of them from M. Lampas da Silva, but she's a genius, so you're going to love those soaps. So again, thank you everybody for writing in. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.